I'm going to call to order the meeting of the House Early Childhood Finance and Policy Division. We'll start by having the clerk take the roll.
Representative Pinto, Chair.
Present.
Representative Katisa Watoon, Vice Chair.
Present.
Representative Franson. Representative Bonner.
Present.
Representative Damas.
Present.
Representative Heintzman. Representative Morrison.
Present.
Representative Pryor.
Present.
Representative Wasilek.
Present.
Representative West.
Okay. And so we do have a quorum, so the next step is approval of the minutes. I want to note there is a technical amendment to the minutes, which is that the date was January 29th rather than 24th, so we'll make that correction before the minutes are finalized. With that correction, do I have a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
Okay, we'll go with Representative Damas. So Representative Damas moves approval of the minutes. Any additions or corrections beyond the one that I noted? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? So the minutes have been approved. So members, we are continuing now to hear from our state agencies about the programs that impact early childhood. We heard on Tuesday, of course, from Department of Human Services about the CCAP program and about some grants and Parent Aware, et cetera. So today we're moving to Department of Education. I do want to highlight for members, I don't know if we still have it in your packets, but hopefully you've still got copies and we can get them to you if you need that. There's a multi-page report by our briefing by the House Research Department on early learning programs is the title of that. And it contains a really nice capsule summary of each of the programs. Many of the programs that we'll be discussing are committee and programs that impact this issue. So that should be a nice guideline for all of us. So with that, I will call up our testifier from MDE, from the Department of Education, to begin the presentation. And again, the purpose of these series of meetings is for us to lay a groundwork, lay a foundation for our knowledge as we're then considering proposals regarding these programs. So I think it's Ms. Burnham. Oh yeah, come on up. There you go. And as you settle in, once you're ready, if our testifiers could introduce themselves and then whichever of you is ready, you can simply begin your presentation.
Mr. Chair, committee members, good morning. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to be here today to talk with you about all of our programs in the Department of Education Division of Early Learning Services. Our government relations director, Caitlin Snyder, is on her way. She had a car starting issue this morning, so she is Ubering on her way over here.
And can you make sure to introduce yourself for the record?
I'm sorry, Bobby Burnham, Director of the Division of Early Learning Services at the Department of Education. And I have a staff member, supervisor for the Early Learning Scholarship Program, Sandy Myers.
Okay. Thank you. Please proceed.
So this morning, we're going to give you an introduction to the multiple programs that our division at the Department of Education implements. And just to set some context, over the last year, year and a half, Department of Education has been doing some real intensive, intentional work around prioritizing equity. And so as an agency, we have committed to 10 commitments of equity. And you can see, on this slide, that what those 10 commitments are. And start early is number 6, which is the focus of our conversation today. Also to set context, from the years 2012 to 2016, Minnesota had an early Race to the Top Early Learning Challenge grant. And through those 4 years, we were able to prioritize multiple birth through age 8 initiatives. And one of the more important initiatives that a cross-agency team worked on for those 4 years was the revision of our early childhood indicators of progress, otherwise known as the ESIPs. These are standards that were combined. Before, we had a set of standards for 0 to 3 and a set of standards for 3 to 5. So now we have one document that our standards give us a core basis for our 0 to 5 work. These ESIPs are also aligned to our K through third grade standards. So the work of our division and cross-agency work really focuses on a comprehensive birth through age 8 system. So with these early learning standards, they really serve as the core to the cross-agency work. The ESIPs serve as the core document to provide coherence not only across programs, but also provide guidance on the technical assistance and professional learning that we all provide in the areas of, professional development, parent information, curriculum, assessment, and instruction. So really the ESIPs are a set of age-appropriate standards that we use in Department of Ed, Department of Human Services, Department of Health to really guide our work. And we are realizing more and more as we are out in communities that this particular set of standards and document really needs to be highlighted. We often get asked, well, how do we define kindergarten readiness or school readiness? Well, we define it by this set of age-appropriate standards. So if you were to look at these standards, it would give you a set of developmental milestones across the 0 to 5 learning continuum. So today, you have asked us to give you an overview of our Head Start programs, our voluntary pre-K and School Readiness Plus program, and the Early Learning Scholarship program. We're going to start today by talking about Early Head Start. And I've tried to separate the Early Head Start slides from the Head Start slides because they're just a little bit different. They serve basically the same purpose around giving children from at-risk backgrounds the skills they need to be successful in school and life, supporting more kids, families, and communities on that path for success. So with Early Head Start, it's the eligibility to receive Early Head Start services as pregnant mothers and children ages birth to 3. We know that this says birth to 5, and we will get you an accurate copy of this PowerPoint. We've made a few revisions. From families at or below the federal poverty line or participating in the Minnesota Family Investment Program who are homeless and or in foster care. You can see on the next line the number of children we serve in Early Head Start and Head Start, and that we have quite a substantial wait list. The funding for those programs, again, is Minnesota supplements the program with state funds. With the additional state funding, Head Start and Early Head Start programs are able to expand services and access to educational opportunities for additional children, thus preparing children and families experiencing multiple risk factors for kindergarten and life. Head Start and Early Head Start support families and children with high needs to make progress on closing the achievement gap upon school entrance and positively impact third grade reading scores, which are 2 of the 5 world's best workforce goals that Minnesota prioritizes.
Ms. Burnham, can you clarify on the eligibility when it says homeless or in foster care? Is that modifying the MFIP reference or the first reference? Like, in other words, is it only families that are homeless or experiencing homelessness or in foster care, and then plus those other elements? Can you just explain that, please?
Mr. Chair, of course. I think, again, that's worded a little not appropriately. So it's not just MFIP mothers who are homeless and in foster care. It's all homeless and foster care children are a general eligibility criteria.
So, Ms. Burnham, if I'm understanding you then, so Early Head Start, essentially it's every child available who is eligible for this program has to be experiencing homelessness or be in foster care. Is that correct?
That's an eligibility criteria.
Okay.
So not all children in right. 0 to 3 Head Start programs are homeless or in foster care.
Okay, I think I understand you. Okay, thank you. And we've got a question, Representative Cortez Batum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick follow-up. So for those children who come in and out of foster care during the eligibility time frame of their life, do they just get kind of added to the wait list? You mentioned a significant wait, and so I'm just wondering, because that's such a transitional time for children, do they just kind of get added on to the end of the wait list, or is there any type of shuffling that happens or waiting, waited?
I believe that these eligibility, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry.
No problem.
I believe that the eligibility criteria bumps them up the wait list.
Okay. Thank you.
But I will confirm that. I'm fairly certain on that. These numbers on this slide also give you the dollar amounts of Head Start and early Head Start in federal and state funds. And in Head Start programs, this might have gotten cut off a little bit, there is a assessment given to monitor progress. And the percentage of children who met developmental targets upon exiting Head Start in fiscal year 16-17, three-year-olds were 84%, and four-year-olds were 78%. Another important program in the Head Start family is the Head Start Early Child Care Partnerships. So in March of 2015, the Administration for Family and Services at the U.S. Department of Education and Human Services awarded six Early Head Start Child Care Partnerships and Early Head Start Expansion Grants in Minnesota. The program integrates Early Head Start comprehensive services and resources into an array of traditional child care and family care settings. The partners layer funding to provide comprehensive services and high-quality early learning environments for low-income working families with infants and toddlers. Long-term outcomes for the program include sustained, mutually respectful, and collaborative Early Head Start child care partnerships, a highly educated and fully qualified workforce, an increased supply of high-quality early learning environments and infant-toddler care and education providers, well-aligned early learning childhood policies, regulations, and resources with quality improvement support at the national, state, and local level.
Ms. Burnham, we had a question from Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as we still are talking about these early Head Start programs, when you talked about that waiting list, I think that for the committee, that's something that we'd like to know more about. Okay. How many people are on that waiting list? How long they're on that waiting list? Because certainly the 0 to 3 is an age group that I think is a priority with us as a committee.
So Ms. Burnham, if you can provide that information afterwards, that'd be great.
Mr. Chair, we'd be happy to do that.
And as long as we interrupted you, I'll just ask one clarification. So it looks like this Early Head Start Child Care Partnership piece is just has federal funding. There's no state funding. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Please continue.
Mr. Chair, this next slide is to just provide a few talking points around the early childhood workforce. I'm sure you've heard, or if you haven't heard, you will, from the Executive Director, Gail Kelly, on the really challenging workforce shortage that early childhood is experiencing. That is in all areas of early childhood, including early childhood special ed, Head Start, community-based child care, school-based voluntary pre-K. So we are really focusing on how we can increase the number of qualified early childhood educators. And Head Start has some really innovative programs that I think not only us as a Department of Education, but all of us can learn from to help kind of grow that workforce. So I just wanted to highlight that we have a very close working relationship with the Minnesota Head Start Association and with Gail Kelly. We are fortunate to have the federally funded early or Head Start collaboration director on staff at MDE. So she is intentionally involved in the work across all of the programs in our division. And Head Start is always at the table. And so we are really, we work closely with them and their innovative programs we use as models and as exemplary models. So we will continue that partnership moving forward for sure.
Ms. Burnham, how geographically spread is Head Start and Early Head Start? I mean, where are these programs operating in the state?
Mr. Chair, that's a great question. And Jeannie Dickhausen, who's the Head Start Collaboration Director, just put a nice colorful map in my inbox this week, and I will be sure you get that. It's widespread. It's, I would say, statewide is well represented, but I will make sure you get that map to show where all the Head Start, Early Head Start, and child care partnerships are.
And please do send that. Are there partnerships with counties through Head Start and Early Head Start, or is this entirely state administered is the connection?
I believe that there are multiple types of partnerships at the county level and the local level, as well as the state level.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, are you interested in knowing the federally funded child care partnerships? The new grants. I do have a list of those.
If you can maybe just give us just a sentence or two just saying what they are, and then if you can send out the information to us, that would be great, and to public as well.
So, Mr. Chair, they are, the expansion grants include PICA and Boise Fort, and the Early Head Start Child Care Partnerships include Mojave, Families First, Tri-County Community Action, and ANOCA.
And Ms. Burnham, it looks like that list is on our slide as well. I'm not sure of the number, but the one that says Early Head Start Child Care Partnerships, it's in bold on that slide as well. Good. And any questions for members on Head Start, Early Head Start? Because otherwise, it looked like you were ready to move on to the next section. Not seeing any, so please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So now we'll give a brief overview of our voluntary pre-kindergarten program, our School Readiness Plus program, and just one slide on the School Readiness Program, because they all kind of interact with one another. Voluntary pre-K. VPK eligibility to participate free of charge is children 4 years of age by September 1. The number of allocated seats the first year of funding was equal to 3,160 seats. And then the subsequent funding for the next years was, 6,160. And then another 1,000 seats were added in the second year of that biennium. And now we are serving 7,160 children through VPK and what is also known as School Readiness Plus. And you can see on the slide the breakdown between those School Readiness Plus. So this is an interesting program. When the funding came the last 2 years, and it was under the School Readiness Plus title, programs were given the choice to implement School Readiness Plus or stick with voluntary pre-K, because so many of them were already implementing a voluntary pre-K, and some later slides will show the differences between those two programs. Most programs, or many of the programs, chose to stay with the voluntary pre-K. There wasn't a lot of interest in implementing yet another new program, set of program standards for four-year-olds.
Ms. Burnham, we've got a question from Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, this is for you. I'm wondering if we can get the numbers of where the voluntary pre-K is located and correspond with the child care providers in the area from the time, about a year before it was implemented in that specific area and then over the last couple of years.
So maybe that would be information that, so Ms. Burnham, presumably you could provide the voluntary pre-K information. I'm just trying to, in terms of getting, I mean,
you'd
the
have to basic get answer. Your, from DHS, yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, basic answer to your question is, I think that's, we should absolutely collect that information. So I'm sort of thinking about making it happen. Maybe Mr. Burris can help coordinate with the respective agencies to get that pulled together. But yeah, sure, of course.
Thank you.
Yep, no problem. So Ms. Burnham, please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So funding voluntary pre-K, voluntary pre-K kindergarten is a grade level based on seat counts of a 0.60 average daily membership. Students are enrolled and designated as a voluntary pre-K grade level in the state data system known as MARS. This entry generates general fund as funding as well as pupil-driven formulas, including compensatory funding. Key instructional components of the program. It's important to note that when we first proposed the program standards for voluntary pre-K, it was aligned with what the United States Department of Ed put out as their definition of high-quality pre-K. At that time, it was aligned with the first round of preschool development grants, so we used that guidance in designing and developing our voluntary pre-K program standards. So key instructional and assessment components include at least 350 hours of instruction, instruction focused on play-based learning to foster multiple domains of learning, including social and emotional, cognitive, physical and motor development, language and literacy skills, including native language and language skills of English learners, and comprehensive program content aligned with state early learning standards and kindergarten through third grade academic standards. Programs must assess each child's skill when the child enters and again before the child leaves the program using an age-appropriate version off of the KEP-approved tools, and then implement strategies that support the alignment of professional development, instruction, curriculum, assessments, pre-K through third grade. Other key program components include classrooms must maintain a 1-to-10 teacher-child ratio with a minimum class or a maximum class size of 20. Teachers must be knowledgeable in early childhood curriculum, assessment, and working with English language learners, and be paid comparable to the K-12 teachers. Parents are involved in program and kindergarten transition planning. Program coordinates with relevant community-based programs and services, including health and social services, to ensure children have comprehensive services, and they must provide a coordinated joint professional development activities for both school district and community-based providers. Key evaluation components for voluntary pre-K include teachers are provided with professional development and training and coaching that is informed by using a teacher child observation tool, and programs must implement a measure of impact of voluntary pre-K by using a self-design model or the MDE designed plan and provide results in the world's best workforce summary to the Commissioner of Education. This past year, we have implemented a monitoring program for voluntary pre-K, and I think it's important to note that when sites submit applications, the superintendent signs a statement of assurances that they will meet all these program requirements.
And Ms. Burnham, Representative Franson has another question or comment.
No, thank you. To the 350 hours of instruction, is that for the days that they are attending the VPK, is that an eight-hour day or is that more like a three-hour day?
Ms. Burnham.
Mr. Chair, committee members, that varies from site to site and from district to district. So the floor level is 350 hours, and each district or site kind of designs what works best for them. It could be half days, 4 days a week, could be three full days. It just depends on what works for their community.
And Representative Franson.
Yep. And then when they are not in the VPK, where are they going for, let's say if it's a half a day,
Are they going on a bus then to home or to a childcare? Are they staying on site for another program? And then on and the same with the 2 days that they may not be there if it's a three-day-a-week program.
Ms. Burnham.
Mr. Chair, all of the above. Like, it's really dependent on what services are available in all the different communities. If it's a half-day program, more than likely there's a supplemental half-day in the before and after child care program, or the half-day VPK is supplemented with other funding streams to make it a full day. It just depends. We are trying to collect that data to see how many of our VPK programs, what duration they are serving kids, and where those, what's happening when those kids aren't in that program. So we can try to gather the data, because VPK is so new, isn't the best, but it's getting better, and our system for collecting it is getting better, so we should have some decent data to share relatively soon.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. And Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Burnham. I think I'm jumping the gun based on what you just said, but I'm wondering if you have any of the data comparing when they enter and when they leave, how effective the program is.
Ms. Burnham.
Mr. Chair, I have a couple slides coming up that explains the impact model that we're implementing.
So, and Ms. Burnham, I actually have a clarification question to ask. On the key program components in the last bullet, can you just explain, just talk a little more, the coordinated joint professional development activities for school district and community-based providers? And I'm just, how does that, what does that look like? I'm just trying to understand what that means.
Mr. Chair, so part of the work that our team at the Department of Ed and our division is doing is really working with communities around that 0 to 8 learning continuum. Mm-hmm. So we are working, the professional development and technical assistance we provide really is focusing on building partnerships and encouraging a mixed delivery system. So we have worked with over 100, almost 200 school districts around building better partnerships with their community child care providers. And one of those areas is being really thoughtful around how can you include your community child care providers in your professional development learning opportunities, which also means the child care community needs to be inclusive of the early or the school-based community in those their offerings as well. We have a strong partnership with Child Care Aware in Ann McCauley, and so we are continually trying to think of ways to encourage more intentional, thoughtful opportunities to connect early childhood providers and the school-based providers.
Okay. Thank you. I think Representative Pryor has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your patience. Thank you for your patience in answering these questions as we, you know, really try to understand the programs. You know, it's something I've heard about, but I'm not 100% familiar with, right? So I appreciate the overview that we're doing right now. When eligibility for the program, it's just age? And then do we have information about the families that are using the program, the children that are entering? Where they stand, you know, relative to, the poverty level, how many of them have free and reduced lunch and that kind. And then also, are we reaching when we use the equity lens and disadvantaged groups, who's in this program? And are we reaching some of these groups that we're trying to reach?
Ms. Burnham.
Mr. Chair, that's a really good question, and thank you for that. When we determine who is eligible for VPK because it's not fully funded, we have to prioritize districts who are eligible, and we prioritize that list by free and reduced lunch. So those programs who are getting voluntary pre-K money right now are those programs who have the highest poverty and the highest free and reduced lunch numbers. VPK, you know, if it were fully funded, it would be, available to everyone. But because it's not, we make sure that the kids who are most at risk are on the top of the list to receive those services. Now, School Readiness Plus is more targeted, which we'll get into in a minute.
And Representative Franson.
Okay, could you clarify? So the VPK is going into an area of lower income, correct? And then within that, is there a specific income guideline, or is it any income can enter that program?
Ms. Burnham.
Mr. Chair, so the way that the priority list is, we use the previous year's incoming kindergarten data to determine the free and reduced lunch count priority list. So once a district receives or is on the priority list and is determined how many seats they are eligible for, they distribute the seats. You know, we encourage them to serve the most at-risk kids, but with voluntary pre-K, any four-year-old is eligible.
Okay. Representative Franson.
So then it's possible, which what is probably happening, is those that actually need the help the most are not getting the most help. They may not be in the program.
Ms. Burnham.
Mr. Chair, the communities that are getting voluntary pre-K money are the communities that show the highest need.
And then, but Representative Franson.
Correct. I understand that. But once people, the families apply, it may not be the kids themselves that are in the program that actually need the help.
Ms. Burnham.
Mr. Chair, that could be happening in certain communities, but more than likely, the communities that are getting voluntary pre-K funding, probably, you know, though that funding, because it's limited, is going to those kids who are most at risk.
It looks like there may be another testifier here who may be wanting to answer Representative Franson's question or comment. So can you please introduce yourself for the record and then please.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. Caitlin Snyder, Minnesota Department of Education, Government Relations. I think that Ms. Burnham explained my situation this morning. There's a 3 to 8 hour wait for a AAA truck in case anyone needs that information. Is that helpful? That was surprising information for myself. But I think that Representative Franson highlights an interesting point. So this is something that would be hypothetically possible, but if you look at the enrollment data of who is enrolling in these programs, we don't see discrepancies like that. If anything, the concentration of poverty for your pre-kindergarten class tends to be higher than your overall concentration of poverty, so we can provide this information to the committee if that would be of interest.
And please do provide the information, Representative Franson, though.
Could you provide us with the number of kids in the VPK who are eligible for free or reduced lunch?
It sounds like that, and then it sounds like as part of the broader, because it sounds like you're going to provide some broader enrollment information as well, but certainly addressing Representative Franson's question.
Yes, is that, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good, thank you. Okay. And so please, please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now we will go over the School Readiness Plus program. So this was funded this last biennium. School Readiness Plus eligibility to participate free of charge. Children 4 years of age by September 1, and they must exhibit one or more of the following risk factors. Qualifies for free and reduced meals, is an English learner, is homeless, is in foster care, has an individual education plan or interagency intervention plan, and has a risk factor identified through health and developmental screening. So you can see that the School Readiness Plus program targets those kids more specifically. You can see the number of seats allocated for 2018 and 2019 and what the funding levels have been. This is the funding stream that will end June 30th. And again, similar to VPK, it's funded at a 0.60 ADM. And these kids generate general education funding as well as pupil-driven formulas, including compensatory funds.
Ms. Burnham, so if I'm understanding right with the connection with Representative Franson's question, so with School Readiness Plus, the children, not just the districts, but the children themselves with the state requirement, they have to exhibit one of these vulnerability factors or risk factors that are listed here. Am I understanding that right?
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Okay, thank you.
Some other key instructional components of School Readiness Plus. Some are similar to VPK and some are not. In School Readiness Plus, you must provide at least 350 hours of instruction, provide program and instruction aligned to state guidelines and based on research. Programs must assess each child's skills when the child enters and again before the child leaves the program. Key program components include classrooms must ensure an appropriate student-child ratio, must have a licensed teacher, coordinate kindergarten transition planning, involve parents. Programs must coordinate with relevant community-based activities and cooperate with adult basic education. And there is no requirement in School Readiness Plus for evaluation. Now the next several slides give a brief comparison of voluntary pre-K and School Readiness Plus, as does the chart, which might make it a little bit easier to understand that the differences between the program. The difference, the eligibility difference is all in VPK, all four-year-olds are eligible, and in School Readiness Plus, you must be four, but also exhibit one of those other eligibility factors. So yes, School Readiness Plus is more targeted. Again,
and Ms. Burnham, I think Representative Franson has a question.
I'm just wondering if you can clarify the licensed teacher portion. What does that look like? Is it a licensed teacher, or are we talking a different type of license?
Ms. Burnham.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I didn't hear the first part of that question.
Representative Franson.
I was wondering if you could clarify the licensed teacher portion.
Ms. Burnham.
Mr. Chair, certainly. So you must have a license in early child care and in education. So you must be a licensed early childhood teacher to teach in a School Readiness Plus classroom.
Maybe, Ms. Burnham, I'll just ask, is that is not true in the voluntary pre-K program?
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Okay. Thank you.
You can see at the bottom of that chart what the funding is, so I don't know that we need to go over that again.
As long as we have this up, though, and this may be a question for Ms. Adrians, I'm not sure. What would this look like going forward without any change? Like, I think the School Readiness Plus funding ends, so those seats disappear. Do the voluntary pre-K seats stay the same in terms of what has been built into the budget so far? Obviously, we'll be setting a new two-year budget, but I'm just trying to understand how these numbers would look like going forward based on previous budgets, either from Ms. Burnham or from our House research staff.
Mr. Chair, the way I understand it, the only seats moving forward, if there isn't additional funding to hold the School Readiness Plus seats harmless, would be the original VPK seats of 3,160.
And so, Ms. Burnham, the 3,403 seats then from 2019, I'm just looking on this slide under seats allocated by children, those are seats that were funded via School Readiness Plus, and the districts just chose to be using voluntary pre-K programs. I'm not sure if you understand my question.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, that is correct. So okay. Those 3,403 seats are from sites who chose to implement the VPK standards versus the School Readiness Plus standards, okay. Most likely because they were already implementing a VPK program. They just got additional seats, and so they weren't interested in implementing yet another set of program standards. And then those 597, so, you know, we're looking at, if I'm doing my math correctly, about 4,000 seats that we would lose if we didn't hold School Readiness Plus funding harmless.
And I'm seeing a bunch of nods from House Research as you were talking, so it looks like they agree with your assessment as to how the numbers work anyway. So, okay, thank you. Okay, good. And to Representative Pryor's comment before, I'm finding it useful to go through. I hope that my members don't mind this this process, but it seems like it's helpful for all of us to understand at least the basics and have the facts, and then we'll be having plenty of discussions, I know, as we go forward, but make sure that we have these details, all of us. So anyway, I don't see any other questions right now, so Ms. Burnham, we're not interrupting you quite yet, so please. Actually, sorry, we do. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Burnham. Just to clarify, so with the seats that we already have, the 4,000 we just discussed, I think there was around 3,000 before that, but that does not include any of the, I think if I'm doing the math correctly, it's around 4,000 to 5,000 that are sitting on the waiting list for those programs, if you combine them together. So those are not included in any of the seats that we have, correct?
Ms. Burnham.
Mr. Chair, that's a really good question. We do have quite a substantial list of sites and districts who applied for voluntary pre-K that were not funded due to the money being capped. I can get you that information on those numbers of how many that would be, but it would be at least between 3,000 and 4,000 children, if not more.
Sounds like that would be helpful for us to have that information. We have quite a list of things, quite a list of information coming to us. You have to have a hearing just on all those. So, okay. Please continue, Ms. Burnham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just continuing on with a couple more comparisons, you can see in the key instructional component section around assessment, the hours are the same. The comprehensive program content aligned with state early learning standards. We actually call out standards in K-3 standards in VPK, and in School Readiness Plus, it calls out instruction aligned with state guidelines. Well, we hope that programs are using the ESIPs as those state guidelines. And then there's the common piece of where children must be assessed entering and exiting the program. The one difference is that we require VPK programs to use one of our approved tools, which is aligned to the standards. And then they submit that information through the World's Best Workforce Plan and through the measuring impact component. And then the other component in VPK is that important alignment piece to professional development, and then looking at instruction and assessment through that pre-K through third grade curriculum. Other key comparisons of the two programs is the ratio. We are very specific in VPK that the ratio must be 1 to 10 and a maximum class size of 20 to have the highest impact. We would like teachers to be knowledgeable in early childhood curriculum and be paid comparably, whereas School Readiness Plus must provide a licensed teacher. Parent involvement is similar in both. But we want parents to be highly involved in the transition planning, program coordination with relevant community-based services around health and social services is a priority, and then that coordinated professional development between school districts and community-based providers. And then the evaluation component. We're getting very excited about the data we are able to collect with this VPK impact measure that we have implemented. And we know that the lack of data showing the impact of the millions of dollars that we're spending on early childhood is an issue among everyone. So the system we are building across our division and across different agencies is really going to enhance our ability to collect and look at that data. So speaking about that data, again, through our Race to the Top opportunity, we worked on the development of a comprehensive P3 system. P3 is defined as prenatal through third grade. And as many of you know, the kindergarten entry profile, which was formerly known as the school readiness study, was one of those projects in Race to the Top that we revised. And in that process, we developed a menu of assessment tools that are closely aligned to the ESEPs that we, those who voluntarily agree to participate in our kindergarten entry profile study use. But we were able to also include that in the VPK statute, where programs must implement and measure the impact of voluntary pre-kindergarten by using either their own method or the MDE designed model to provide and provide results in the world's best workforce plan. So this model that we have worked to define is 100 of 100 of two sites chose to use the MDE design model.
And Ms. Burnham, actually, before you continue with this slide, if you don't mind, I think Representative Cotizo Watoon had a question regarding the last one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Burnham, I just was hopeful to clarify some of the tools that are accessible to districts and communities providing these services that align with the kindergarten entry profile. So I see Teaching Strategies Gold, and that is what my school district uses. The work sampling system and the desired results development of profile, those other two that are available across the state.
Ms. Burnham.
Mr. Chair, that's a good question. So during the 4 years of Race to the Top, we piloted several tools. And I think the first phase of the pilot, we took the eight most commonly used tools in the state and determined which ones were most aligned to the standards. And so we determined that four tools were most aligned to the standards. And then the second phase of that work was aligning the tools to each other. So when we compared the results from the TS Gold to the DRDP, we were comparing apples to apples and not apples to oranges. So that work has been done. So we have determined that these three tools, desired results, development or profile, which is a free tool, these are all online tools. TS Gold, I would say, is the most widely used tool across the state as well as across the nation. And then work sampling system, which was the tool that Minnesota had used for years. So we felt that because they were one of the four that were most aligned, keeping that. We also felt very strongly about giving districts a choice and not mandating one tool. So these three tools are the three tools that are currently on the kindergarten entry profile menu. So that the kindergarten entry profile is a process that is, it's an assessment given the first 8 to 10 weeks of the kindergarten year. So currently in Minnesota, we do a sampling. School districts volunteer to participate in the kindergarten entry profile. Because it's voluntary, we don't get a high, it's less than 10%. So when we're asked to, in the past, to provide school readiness data, we hesitate because the sampling that we have is less than 10% and not representative of the state. So what we're finding and what we're excited about is the potential of the VPK impact measure, where all VPK programs are required to provide us with impact measure data, which is coming in the next slide.
Follow up from Representative Cortez Watoon.
Thank you so much for that explanation. So to clarify, and correct me if I'm wrong, are all children across the state of Minnesota required to undergo some type of testing before they move into kindergarten?
Ms. Burnham.
Mr. Chair, the only thing that is required of children before they enter kindergarten is a health and developmental screening.
Okay, and that's not the same as
no.
Representative, okay. Thank you very much.
And Representative Franson.
Hi. Just a clarification on slide 19. The staff ratio on the VPK and the SRP, the classrooms must ensure appropriate student to staff ratio should actually be 1 to 10.
Ms. Burnham, sounds like that's our question.
It's the same as the VPK.
Ms. Burnham.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. What was the question?
I think there isn't no question. It's more of a clarification, a correction, that the school readiness plus classroom ratio is the same as the voluntary pre-K.
Ms. Burnham, she's so asking for clarification that there's an error on that first bullet on the SRP side, and it should be the same as the first bullet on the VPK side, I think, is the question, and just finding out if you agree.
Mr. Chair, I'll have to look at the statute. I cannot recall what's in the school administration statute. There could be an error in the chart.
It sounds like Representative Franson is pretty confident. So I guess if you think that there's an error, let us know, and otherwise we'll assume that she's got it right. But if you think that your slide is correct, then I guess please let us know that.
Oh,
and it sounds like she'd appreciate you pointing. Okay,
Mr. Chair, I see what you're looking at. It was down the chart. So yes, in the ratio and group size, it says same as VPK. So you are correct. I was looking at the slide that does not indicate that. So
Ms. Burnham, so it sounds like there is that first bullet on the SRP side is the same as the first bullet on the VPK side. They both have a 1-to-10 teacher child ratio, et cetera, et cetera. Is that correct? Just want to make sure.
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Thank you, Ms. Burnham. Okay. And on this slide, many of us don't serve on the education committee. So just can you just briefly say what it says? World's Best Workforce Annual Summary. What is that?
Mr. Chair, certainly. So there is legislation that is named World's Best Workforce, and maybe Caitlin can go into it. But there is four goals, and we as a division work to support programs support districts in designing and implementing their World's Best Workforce plan. Goal one of that plan is school readiness. Goal two is around third grade reading. And so every district has to submit a plan and submit a summary. So we work with school districts on what is an appropriate school readiness plan, what is appropriate data to collect, what are some strategies you could implement to make sure you reach your goals, and then once a year they submit summaries. And so now is the time of year that we are reviewing World's Best Workforce summaries. And so we're looking at that early childhood piece of those summaries to see how well school districts did on not only naming an appropriate school readiness goal, but how well they met their school readiness goal. And then we are providing feedback. It also gives my staff the opportunity to kind of make a list of what the needs are out in school districts around this area. So when we read goals from World's Best Workforce plans that may or may not be appropriate, that tells us the type of guidance they need to do better in that area.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Oh, yeah, was it Snyder?
Yes.
Okay,
Ms. Burnham did a great encapsulation of the World's Best Workforce statute. The one thing I would add to that is that the World's Best Workforce includes statewide goals, so the relevant goal for this area being that all students are ready for kindergarten, as well as local goals that are set by the district. So when she says that her division works to provide feedback and guidance, she's providing guidance to the local goals that the district set in order to meet the statewide goal.
Helpful clarification. Thank you, Ms. Snyder. Okay, and please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this next slide gives some understanding of what the voluntary pre-K impact measure entails. So the MDE impact measure plan and report is designed to help districts and charter schools understand the outcomes from voluntary pre-K and school readiness plus, as well as share the outcome information in a way that can inform district and charter schools' World's Best Workforce reports and support program planning, professional development, and decision making at local and state levels. So data collected by the voluntary pre-K impact measure includes child demographic data, individual item level assessment data, and program data. So this has been an ongoing effort to collaborate with other teams, other divisions at MDE, across state agencies, to develop the impact measure. It's certainly been a collaboration internally between our early childhood special education team and all the other teams in the Division of Early Learning Services. The Early Childhood Special Education team has several federal reporting requirements, and over the years they have been building a system to collect and then provide information to their programs. So we have been collaborating with them on building that system so we don't have multiple systems happening and districts only have one reporting protocol to implement. So We have developed what we're calling the Early Childhood Education Data Warehouse. Is being developed with consideration of how to collect and use data for a wider variety of reporting purposes. So when schools who offer School Readiness Plus and Voluntary Pre-K do their entry and exit assessment using one of these tools, we are building a system through the use of Tableau, and I am not a data or a data system person, but everybody seems to be pretty excited about this Tableau system. But it's fairly a drawn out process. But we are able to, once we get the data, the different levels, the child data, the individual item data, and the program data, to produce a very comprehensive report back to the sites to really help them inform their work, their professional development, and their priorities, as well as give the state item level data that it so desperately has been asking for years. It's not perfect. It's far from perfect right now, but it is a start that we're pretty excited about. I think it's going to go a long ways toward helping us meet some of the Office of the Legislator Auditor recommendations. And with the recent award of the Preschool Development Grant, it has given us some resources to continue building out this system.
And for highlight for members, we'll be hearing more about that report, a week from today, and then also more about the grant that was just referenced for preschool development planning. So, okay, thank you. Please continue.
So we did collect some data on that initial year around, so the requirement in voluntary pre-K is that teachers must use a teacher interaction tool, and so you can see on this slide that the number of programs using which one of these tools. By far, the class tool, which some of you may be familiar with, Head Start uses it, many parent-aware rated programs use it, and then there's the Charlotte Danielson tool. Charlotte Danielson has a K-12 tool that many schools use, and they have adopted their tool to be used in the early childhood classroom environment. And then the KEP approved assessment tools out of 111 districts and charter schools. You can see that the TS Gold is the most widely used, followed by work sampling. And then I wanted to share a little bit about the VPK application process, which we are in the middle of. So the application process, the online application, opened January 2nd. And we'll closed at 4 p.m. yesterday. That's the 30th, right?
Yes. Yeah.
We provide multiple opportunities for technical assistance through this application process. Instructions for application and webinar information was sent to all districts and charter schools early on, December 21st. And multiple emails have been sent out reminding and prodding districts to get their applications in. Online application also includes the opportunity for districts and charters to opt into the parent-aware auto rating process if you're VPK funded. And we provided weekly webinars, updated Q&A document, and responded to, I must say, well over hundreds of TA calls. So my team is really dedicated to supporting districts through this process. It's a little sticky because there's the School Readiness Plus and the voluntary pre-K, and as Sandy's about to share, around the Pathway 2 scholarships. But every year we go through this continuous improvement process, and every year I think we get a little bit better and schools, districts are a little bit happier with us.
And Ms. Burnham, how does the fact that a district has previously offered VPK, like, is that a factor in the application process going forward? Does it sort of all start anew? Does it, you're not at all, you know, if you've had it before, you get it again? If there's a, how does that work?
Mr. Chair, that's a good question. So the original 74 districts who get those 3,160 seats are guaranteed those seats. Every year with whether if in the last biennium, since we received new funding, we reran the formula. So we reran that list of eligible sites, and it changes a little bit from year to year, as do state demographics. So every year We send out information about what you're eligible to apply for, and they submit applications.
So I guess I'm a little confused. So we had said that just built into the budget, if the School Readiness Plus money goes away, then you're just down to the original VPK, which would be those original, I guess, 74 districts. So if none of them chooses to drop out, then do they just get it and wouldn't be an additional application process, because then the money's all allocated for those districts. I feel like I'm maybe missing something, though.
So we run an application, Mr. Chair, sorry. We run an application process every year because, like I said, programs change, decisions change, so demographics change. So hypothetically, one of those or more of those 74 districts may not be able to use the allocations given to them. So in that case, we would have to go to reallocate those funds to the most the next eligible site or district.
Okay, thank you. Okay, please continue.
With that, I'm going, I know, Mr. Chair, school readiness is on next week's agenda. I just wanted to make the committee members aware that we do have a school readiness program in addition to a school readiness plus program. The school readiness program has been around for many years, and it serves children ages 3 to kindergarten entrance. It is a community education program which lives in Fund 4 versus a formula-based program. And I won't take too much time to go into that because we'll go into greater detail next year, but I just wanted to put that on everyone's thinking list.
And we have a question for Representative Wasilewicz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering, Ms. Burnham, if you can, I'm wondering about the, a couple slides back, the voluntary pre-kindergarten impact measure plan. Is that something that's going to give us data just on kind of the VPK program? Because I noted that the school readiness, we're not really getting a lot of data on outcomes from that program, at least from what my reading of the slides. So I'm wondering if you can clarify, is that just kind of the VPK data kit from those kids, or is there additional programs that are going to be part of that measure that we can get data on?
Ms. Burnham.
Mr. Chair, that's a really good question. Thank you. Currently, the only program required to submit data to us is voluntary pre-K. There is statutory requirements for school readiness to assess upon entry and exit. There's just no language that says they need to provide us data. So right now, it's only voluntary pre-K in those school readiness plus programs. No, just voluntary pre-K. I'm getting my...
Okay. All right. Thanks. Please continue. Sounds like we're turning to the scholarship, early learning scholarships. Now, if you can introduce yourself again for the record, and then please feel free to begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. My name and members of the committee, my name is Sandy Myers, and I am a supervisor with the Early Learning Services Division, and I oversee the Early Learning Scholarship Program. Okay. So, try to shift over here a little bit. Starting with eligibility, so the original language with early learning scholarships was really focused on serving low-income children that are 3 and 4 years of age by September 1 of the school year that are low-income and would have a likelihood to have a greater opportunity gap than other children in their same age group. In the 2017 legislative session, the language expanded to include children birth through 5 if they were from 4 priority populations. And I'm going to go into more depth at what that change in statute looked like and the impact on who was served a little bit later down the line. But those 4 categories were children of teen parents under the age of 21 that are pursuing a high school diploma or a general equivalent diploma, those that are experiencing homelessness within the last 24 months, children in the foster care system, and children in need of child protective services. And we did do a lot of coordination with the Minnesota Department of Human Services on really defining what does that look like for a child to be in child protective services and partnering with them around training and support and information out to the county and tribal social service systems. So in the next little bucket, you can see kind of the historical levels of the number of children served. with early learning scholarships. I went back to 2015, but they're also, the original legislation started in fiscal year 14, and there was just over 5,000 children in 14, as well as the funding on the next level. And you can see that it has grown pretty significantly from $23 million in fiscal year 2015 to this year we are working with an appropriation of $70.2 million. So pretty strong increase in the amount of funding that's available, and we're serving more and more children with this funding pot. Okay, so some key program components. We work with scholarships administered two different ways. The first way is we call Pathway One, where we work with area administrators that are located throughout the state of Minnesota, as well as two tribal organizations, Leech Lake and White Earth, that administer scholarships for members of their tribe and families that may reside on their tribal lands. We also allow four-star rated parent-aware programs that are already serving eligible children for scholarships or have a waiting list that includes eligible children that they can apply for a certain number of scholarship seats that they then award to children to be able to attend their program or to be able to have additional days of the week, to be able to provide wraparound services. So there's a multiple ways that, programs are using Pathway $2 to increase access for low-income children. We also provide scholarships on a tiered basis that are that's based on the parent-aware rating that that family chooses to use their scholarship in. The most scholarships dollars go to a four-star rated program up to $7,500, and it goes down based on the tier that the parent-aware rated program is at. And that's a incentive for them to continue their professional development, continue to improve their quality, so that they, in fact, can be of a broader service to the families that they're serving with their scholarship funds. So our outcome measure, because we're working with multiple programs, the Early Learning Scholarship is really the funding source, so we are not directly providing the services to children with a scholarship. Those are being served in childcare, both family and center-based child care, Head Start programs, and school-based programs. So they themselves would use assessment and tools to support the children and monitor their growth. But what our outcome measure is we're looking at, are we increasing the number of low-income children that are accessing high-quality programs? In our accountability, we've recently, within this fifth year of administering early learning scholarships, have embedded a higher level of monitoring, including application and eligibility review, and we're doing this for both Pathway 1 and Pathway 2. We're making sure that we're doing an overview and a review of the invoicing process. We're making sure that there's fidelity of implementation of the program, and we're most importantly, though, we're using what we're learning through the monitoring process to continue to improve the program, be more responsive to both programs that are serving low-income children as well as families that want to access the program. Okay, so again, just to recap, the Pathway 1 is awarded through an area administrator. That scholarship stays with the child. If they change programs, the funds go with that child to use that whatever program they choose, as long as it is a parent-aware rated program. And the Pathway 2 funds, because those are awarded to that four-star rated program, the funding stays there, and if a child leaves, they can award the balance to a new child in their program. Children are awarded that scholarship for a 12-month period from their start date. And once a child receives a scholarship, they're eligible to continue to receive that scholarship each year until they are kindergarten age, so September 1st of the year that they would be eligible to start kindergarten. They do not have to re-qualify. We do request that they reapply, and it's more of a renewal, and that's more to make sure that we still have their consent for data, that they still understand the terms of the scholarship. So it's more of a reinforcing what it is that they have as a family to use. And again, scholarships can be used and awarded up to $7,500. Programs can also use this if they're with Pathway 2. They can use it to blend and braid with other funding streams. Ms. Burnham mentioned that the VPK allocation is at a 0.6 unit, and so that may not cover full day, full week. Sometimes they're using Pathway 2 to blend to create more capacity, so they're turning that VPK slot into a full day slot or a multiple days. Some of the school districts and Head Starts are using it to provide wraparound care. Child care centers may be using it to blend it with child care assistance, and some have their own scholarship pot. We do know that $7,500 will not cover the full slot for every single program type for every single child, and we'll continue to work and review what that appropriate amount for a scholarship could be, and that's at the commissioner's discretion how to award that. But we do use child care assistance market rate surveys to help determine what that rate is.
Ms. Myers, I think I may have missed Ms. Burnham's reference to the 0.6. Can you just somebody just clarify? Is that saying that it's, you know, so 0.6 of a full day essentially? So if you can just clarify that, because I guess I must have missed that the first time, Ms. Burnham.
Mr. Chair, it's 0.6 of a full 0.10 funding amount. So it doesn't it could equal a full day, but so the K-12 formula is based on a 1.0 ADM, and so the voluntary pre-K is a 60% of that is funded.
I think I'm understanding. So if you did think of it in terms of time, it might then, as you were referencing before, three full days out of a 5-day week, for example. But it's set at but the idea is that it's that 60% of a full time student in elementary school, you know, heading on up. Am I saying that right?
Mr. Chair, a full funding level, and I don't know what that currently is.
Mr. Chair,
Ms. Snyder,
in education funding, there's a level of funding called the basic formula, and that drives most of general education funding. So the 0.6 is a reference to what you would multiply the general education funding by. So there's the basic formula and a number of other multipliers, just to keep things nice and confusing. So the minimum of 350 hours is about a 0.4266 to the maximum of 0.6. So when you include all of the multipliers, the average that a typical student get is in the neighborhood of $10,000 to $12,000. So it'd be 0.6 times that overall funding amount.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Snyder. And looks like we've got a question from Representative Pryor.
And just on that same line, as I understand, that's two, and for the chair and for the committee, high school secondary level, it's 1.2 is the formula. So I guess if stating this correctly, we're saying that this early childhood is 0.6, the K through six.
I believe so.
Ms. Snyder.
So sixth grade is one, and then secondary is 1.2. So it's the, you know, in terms of the percentage of the formula, it's the lowest amount is for these is for the early childhood, even though our ratio is 1 to 10.
And I was seeing nodding from the testifiers, so it looks like they agree with your assessment, Representative Pryor. Ms. Myers, could you just also clarify the pathway and pathway two? I feel like there's been a lot of discussion about that, what the impact is of having the funding be tied to that. Tied through the site versus through the individual child. If there's how do programs use those pathway two funds versus if funding is coming in via pathway one?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I can explain that. When programs apply for a pathway two funding allocation to award scholarships, they're determining how they're going to use that. So they're in their application, they're telling us if they're using it to provide transportation, because oftentimes the slots exist, but there isn't any way for low-income children to get to and from those slots. They're often using it to fund wraparound child care programs. They're using it to add additional days. Again, it's very locally driven, as is other parts of the early childhood program development. So they're looking at what the community needs are and blending and braiding the funding available to maximize their opportunities to meet the community needs.
Thank you. Okay. Please continue.
Okay, so as I had mentioned that all children must be at or below 185% of the federal poverty level, but we allow two different ways for a family to qualify, and written right into statute is one option that allows a family to utilize documentation of a public funded program that they might already be participating in, and this helps lessen the burden on the family to come up with additional financial documents. So if they're already receiving Minnesota Family Investment Program, child care assistance, free and reduced lunch, child and adult care food program, the food distribution program on tribal communities, SNAP, Head Start, or if a child is in foster care, all we need to do is document that program is associated with that child, and they're automatically eligible for a scholarship. And right now, historically, that has been the bulk of how families have qualified for the program is through that option one. In fiscal year 2018, it was 72%. And then we just have another 28% that actually have to submit paycheck stubs or completed tax returns to determine their eligibility. And so it is the lesser of the two ways that families verify that they're income eligible to receive a scholarship. So most are using an already verified program to determine their eligibility.
Ms. Myers, do we believe that many of the families using option two would be eligible for, this seems like a pretty wide array of services to low-income families. Do we think that they are eligible and simply choosing not to use that path? Or do you understand what I'm asking?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We don't know why a family may not be choosing to use the option one. We are assuming that they currently maybe have chosen none of those programs, or they might also be on a waiting list for one of those programs. So they might be eligible, but that program doesn't exist either with an opening for them. So it's, we don't have a follow-up request or question to the families of why they do. I will add, though, that we work with both Pathway 2 programs, and because they have to be four-star rated, as well as our area administrators, on making sure those families are connected to other resources that they may be eligible for. That is a primary goal of this program, is to work in partnership, excuse me, in tandem with other programs to make sure that families truly are accessing resources.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, so I had mentioned earlier the expanded language that was included in the 2017 legislature that not only gave children birth to three eligibility to scholarships if they were from one of the priority populations, but it also made all children up to the age of five a priority for scholarships if they were in one of those four. And you can see in fiscal year 2018, we did serve a significant number of children that were from these priority populations. One thing to keep in mind is, as I had said earlier, once a child receives a scholarship, they are eligible to renew. So we're not fully awarding brand new children scholarships each year because some children are renewing. But this 3,269 are children newly awarded in 2018. That were from one of those priority populations. So one of the areas that we have been particularly focusing on at the Department of Education is looking at the opportunities we have with our education programs to be able to support the Interagency Commission on Preventing and End Homelessness. So I pulled that one out specifically to highlight because we have seen a large growth in the number of families experiencing homelessness that have accessed early learning scholarships. Over time, it is conceivable that children that are from one of these four priority populations will be the only children that are awarded new scholarships because that it just they renew each year, and then we set aside a pot of money that we ask each area administrator to make sure that they keep and reserve some access funds so that regardless of what time in the year that family might be identified, there may be a scholarship available. Even with that, we do still have at the end of the year, we did have some families that were from the priority populations on the waiting list. And at the end of fiscal year 18, there was just over 1,400 eligible children on that waiting list.
Thank you. Please continue.
So I know you may be curious as to who are the area administrators, and as I said, they are located throughout Minnesota, organized by governor's economic development regions in the metro area, Region 11. In the last biennium, we actually split the geographic out between Ramsey, Hennepin, and then East and West Metro to make sure that there wasn't an overlook of those first and second tier suburbs that are experiencing tremendous growth in poverty and disparities as well. So we wanted to make sure that there was specific concentration there. We also utilize a funding formula that's based on poverty concentration when the allocation is awarded. And for 2019, we have a little over $38 million that will be awarded via Pathway 1 and $28 million that will be awarded for Pathway 2. The reason why it's not split proportionately as it had been in the first few years of scholarship, also in that 2017 language was the language to hold Pathway 2 at the same level as 2017. So we have not grown the number of programs that are receiving Pathway 2 funding.
Ms. Myers, can you just clarify, I guess I'm a little confused, it says MDE directly funds school districts, charter schools, and Head Start organizations. Those are entities that are acting as administrators. They're not, I mean, the providers that would be eligible for that funding are not limited to school districts, charter schools, and Head Start organizations. Is that right? Just trying to get this clarified.
I'm sorry. So under the Pathway 1 column, those are sub-grantees that the Department of Education uses to award scholarships. Families can use them at any program type. Okay. As well as in Pathway 2, any program type can apply to have slots.
So, Ms. Myers, if I'm understanding you right, the reference in that second column to school districts, charter schools, and Head Start organizations, those are serving as administrators, as grantees that then can themselves award Pathway 2 funding to individual providers, correct?
Mr. Chair, yes, that is correct. And the reason why I called that bullet out is we have an early learning scholarship administration system that school districts and Head Starts directly enter their children in request payment out of. We don't have that same relationship with the private child care, though they still, when they're awarded Pathway 2, they directly award to their families. We just use one of the 12 area administrators, works as that conduit between the Pathway to child care and getting their funding. So they enter on behalf of the child care into that system. But they, the way they're awarded and the way they then award children is exactly the same whether they're a Head Start, school district, or child care.
And one other clarification, Pathway 2 I know is limited to four-star parent aware only, is, I believe that's right, correct me if that's wrong, but Pathway 1 is can be, children can use it at any provider, families can at any provider that is parent aware rated at all. Am I saying all that correctly?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. However, as there is a stipulation in the statute that as of July 1, 2020, only 3- and 4-star rated programs will be eligible to accept scholarships. This actually had been part of the original statute, and it did go into play as of July 1 of 2016, and then a year later it was actually rolled back to expand a few more years to continue to help build capacity of the community-based child care programs to reach that 3- and 4-star level. But we are anticipating that will change again as of July 1. And with this partnership that we work with the Department of Human Services, as well as their grantee, the Child Care Aware System, who is charged with recruitment and support of programs to get that higher parent aware rating, we make sure that they know where we foresee gaps in the number of 3- and 4-star rated programs, and we work in tandem to make sure that there's targeted recruitment efforts in those areas.
Thank you. And it looks like we have a question from Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Myers, just a point of clarification on eligibility for the scholarship programs.
Yes.
Teen parents, and then I thought I heard you say age 21.
Correct,
Ms. Myers.
Representative Chair, members of the committee. It does say that the teen parent is identified. The definition of teen parent for scholarships is under the age of 21 and pursuing their high school or GED.
Thank you.
Okay. Please continue. Looks like you're almost done.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll just end with just this last slide just tells you who are the area administrators that we are working with throughout the state. And you can see that all counties, all 87 counties are represented. Well, for the most part, these are all non-governmental organizations as well as the two tribal. So if there are any other questions, I'd be happy to answer any others.
Any questions for that? Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Burnham and Ms. Myers. So I see it sort of spread out amongst multiple slides here, but I'm going to go back to this. I work in a highly technical field, so I'm big on data. And one of the things that would be really helpful for me to really understand the full scope of what we're looking at here would be to have consolidated sort of what is the demand for all of these services across the program, what are the spots that are filled, and what remain unfilled, and look at the totals of those, and also, if possible, to understand where there may be overlap in those numbers. I guess I'm trying to understand big picture. What are we currently serving versus what is the real need that's out there? And that would really help me, and I suspect others on the committee, to really understand the full scope of the program. And it would also be helpful if we could use that in comparison to the current number of students that are being helped by those programs. Again, that gets to the so that we can just really understand where we're at. Because if I'm doing the math correctly, and it feels like we're almost at a 2-to-1 ratio. We're probably helping only about half of the students who really should be helped, if that's my understanding.
Ms.
Thank you.
Ms. Myers. Or whoever, Ms. Snyder, Ms. Burnham, I'm not quite sure. Oh, Ms. Snyder.
We can certainly provide information about what the wait list looks like, what current funding levels are. I would say one of the challenges of providing information about what the overlap might look like between, say, the waiting list of early learning scholarship applicants and voluntary pre-K or other programs is that we only collect information about the wait list for early learning scholarships that says this program is telling us that we have a demand. So we don't have information about where the student is from or other criteria. So we can't say cross-reference that with a school that also applied for voluntary pre-K and say this student exists on both lists. But we can provide certainly more information about what waitlist numbers we have.
And Ms. Burnham, you had something you were going to say to that?
Mr. Chair, in addition, through this recent award of the preschool development grant, we are going to be doing a very extensive, comprehensive stakeholder engagement process around needs assessment. So we are currently, those are all the same questions that this needs assessment is asking, and we have to provide to the federal government. So through this stakeholder engagement process statewide, you know, we hope to get more specific data as well as hear from community members what their priorities and what their community solutions might be on an individual community basis around this early childhood work. So we look forward to sharing that process as we go this next year, as well as any data that we can get that's somewhat complete, we will share with you as soon as we get it.
And we have two more questions. We have to have quick questions and quick answers. Representative Pryor.
I think it's probably quick. On slide number 34, administration and the map that you had there. So the number at the bottom, the 2,624,836. So what is that number referring to?
Ms. Myers.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is the amount of money that the state contracts with those local area administrators to do outreach, access, support them applying, and then actually paying the local service providers for the scholarship.
So of the 38,000, are we saying that just of that total amount, that's the amount that's going to the metro area?
Ms. Myers.
Mr. Chair, no, that 2,624 is the amount that's going to all 12 of those area administrators, and the 38 million is the amount of money that's going to scholarships throughout Minnesota.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Meyer. Ms. Myers. And Representative Wozlik, you'll have the last question here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. I know I heard some mention earlier of the OLA report in discussion, and I'm wondering, I understand that you're working on some of those things. I'm just wondering if we're going to hear more about what sort of things you're already working on so that we know what our role might be in that process as well.
And I can maybe answer just to say that I think we're scheduled for a week from today to hear both about the basics of the report. I know that they have an update and then a response from this department, and I think we're hopeful to get some broader responses too. So is there anything quickly you want to say on that, please, although we're pretty much out of time, but yeah.
Mr. Chair, absolutely. So, yes, I believe the OLA report will be shared with you, as well as any updates on work being done to meet the recommendations. We were asked to provide an update to the OLA probably 3 to 4 weeks ago, so we've got that information ready to go, and we're even going to update it on the work that's been done more recently.
Good. Well, I want to thank our testifiers. Thank you, members, for your patience with all this. I think this is going to be useful in the rest of our session. So with that, we are adjourned.